Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Welcome back, Joe.
Good morning.
And Dayton Daily News State Government reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back.
Hello, listeners.
And Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Good morning.
It looks like the Ohio General Assembly has gone away for the year. Their lame duck session, kind of that classic middle of the night, sort of a train wreck kind of a thing.
That's one way to describe it.
I suppose they call it going to work, but for the rest of us, it's kind of crazy. They might come back, but, you know, Joe, you were tweeting at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Last Friday or Saturday morning?
Friday morning, I guess it was. They wrapped up at 3:30. Well, they wrapped up earlier than that. It was 3:30 when I finally got done reporting on it. I think it was probably more like 1:30 when they wrapped up. But they pushed everything through, tried to get everything done. and, you know, they've set aside the 27th, I believe, is the date that they set aside to come back and deal with vetoes, if necessary. And we do know that the governor has been on record saying that he is going to veto one abortion bill for sure, which is the heartbeat bill, which bans an abortion at the point a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Uh-huh. And then also the governor is not wild about this gun legislation that they just passed. And there's also these pay raises that were attached to another bill that helps like families of fallen police officers and firefighters. Mm-hmm. So there's some things there that the governor could take action on, that he's indicated he would take action on maybe. And so if he does, if he vetoes those things, then the Senate and the House would have to come back and they would have to override those vetoes. The question is, will they be able to do that?
Muster the votes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have sessions, if needed, sessions scheduled for December 27th and 28th. To override a veto, it takes 60 votes in the House and 20 in the Senate. And it's not clear, you know, there weren't enough votes in the Senate on the heartbeat bill. They didn't clear that 20 vote.
Mm-hmm.
And also, even if they did clear, maybe they had 20, you know, it's difficult to get people to come back during the holiday season.
Right.
And also, there may be a different threshold for some lawmakers about whether or not they want to override a governor's veto, mm-hmm. just on principle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say they're likely to be at least one or two override votes, maybe, but some that won't make it. As my colleagues here said, I mean, the heartbeat bill that passed with exactly 60 votes in the House the first time, and that was with literally dragging a final Republican member into Columbus at night in order to cast the 60th vote, just so they could say they've got the 60. It did not get the 20 in the in the Senate. However, excuse me. However, The vote was 18-13 in the Senate, and there were two missing Republicans at the time. One was an open seat that's now been filled by Brian Hill, who I believe is supportive of the bill, and the other one is Frank LaRose, who wasn't there, who's now going to be our Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. I don't know that Frank LaRose would vote for this, but to me it's a long shot that they would try to do a heartbeat bill override. I don't know that either chamber could muster up the votes, especially during a holiday week. People, just so folks understand, having a voting session a day or two after Christmas is extremely rare.
Right.
I've never seen it, and I've been doing this 20 years. And so it is extremely rare to call them in at that time. And some legislators, some told me they're out of town. They're out of state. And we'll probably not be back for those sessions. I mean, heck, Thursday night in the House, there were 14 mm-hmm. members who couldn't even show up for a Thursday night session.
Right.
Because Thursdays are usually not voting sessions. So, you know, the chances of getting everyone crowded into the room for some of these votes may be tough. I am told Larry Obhoff has whipped votes and gotten assurances from some that they would come back for at least the pay raise bill. Mm-hmm. And possibly the gun bill that the governor may veto.
If the governor vetoes. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. pretty much the lame duck session has concluded, except for some possible returns to the chambers after Christmas to override potential vetoes by the governor on a couple bills. If you have a question or comment about lame duck, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The legislative pay raise was tucked into a bill intended to improve benefits for the survivors of first responders. This has ticked off a lot of people. The governor was ticked off about it, too. Why? I mean, it seems like it's dealing with compensation issues.
Sure, and that was the argument that the Speaker of the House, Ryan Smith, made, was that this is a compensation issue. It's a related issue. The lawmakers have not had a pay raise since 2008, yet they, I think, from based on a survey from the National Conference of State Legislatures, Ohio is still among the, I think, the top
three or something like
I think
thought.
Like fifth or sixth
I
highest
was surprised.
Paid lawmakers. Anyway, there's an argument on both sides whether or not this pay raise is a good idea. It kind of put the governor in a box because there's no appropriation included in this bill, which means he does not get a line item veto.
Right.
It's either up or down on the whole bill. And I know that, like, Jay McDonald, the past president of FOP Ohio, has urged the governor
Fraternal
to pass
Order
it.
Of police, yeah.
Right. The police union has said, you know, we really need these benefits for these you know, it's basically widows and orphans of fallen firefighters and police officers would get some extra benefits. The governor, you know, he'll have to, if he doesn't like the pay raise for the lawmakers and for other elected leaders, then he also has to say no to benefits for widows and orphans.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the other thing. I'm seeing this every 2 seconds, it seems like I'm hearing this. There is this widening gap right now between the haves and have-nots in Ohio. And we're seeing it, you know, last week on the floor of the Senate, one of the lawmakers got up. Was it the Senate or the House? Now I've covered so much I can't remember. But one of the lawmakers got up and talked about how in his area of the state, you know, and I think they were talking about the tax that went the capital improvements tax that went to Columbus for the soccer team. But he was talking about how basically in his area of the state, you know, they have crumbling roads and bridges and they don't even have what they need down there.
Mm-hmm.
And how they don't have what they need, yet the government and all these lawmakers are finding millions of dollars to help the soccer team. And so, you know, there's been this have and have not thing. And I think things like pay raises, while they, you know, you can make the case that they haven't had a pay raise for a long time.
10 years.
Yeah. Still, if you look at $70,000 for a part-time job and you go down to some areas of Ohio, people who have full-time jobs don't make, you know, even half that much. And they see that very differently than some of the lawmakers would. So I think there is a political implication here, and we're starting to see it grow.
I will say, based, you know, just on the fact that this was attached to this police and fire survivor benefits bill, some are saying, look, they can't, even if the governor does veto this bill, the argument is they could come back and pass it again next year and make it retroactive. Representative Stephen Huffman was making the argument on the House floor that they could simply they could make it retroactive back to whenever they want. They could go back to the beginning of this year. They could go back to the beginning of last year if they feel like it and give them, and, you know, and pay out all those benefits for over that time. So there is a way to get around that part of it. What you can't get around is the pay raise part, because if they do, you know, some are wondering why are they rushing to get this pay raise bill done this year? Because if they don't, then everybody has to wait, just about everybody has to wait 2 more years before they get a pay raise, because you cannot have a pay raise enacted during your term that takes effect. You have to wait until the next
You can't vote for your own pay raise. You
right.
Have to, so.
But why do you always have to wait until lame duck? Why can't they just vote for the pay raise for the next thing and not wait for
it? Because it might not go over
it's
well
politics.
With the voters.
Well, that's,
right.
Yeah, okay. That's a pure politics.
Politics.
They wait until this time of year because they don't want to vote this before the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there is a good argument to be made that we should get rid of the lame duck session. We should make sure that You if you want to rush bills through, that's fine, but you have to do it before November 7th or whenever
before
the election is.
Before election day.
And this is the kind of stuff that they will pass after the election because they feel like voters aren't really paying as much attention, and frankly, a lot of the folks doing the voting aren't going to have to be on the ballot again.
Right. So another bill that I think is kind of ripe for a possible override or a possible veto from the governor is the Senate Bill 145, which is it would outlaw a very common procedure used in second trimester abortions. I think there were like maybe 3,400 dilation and evacuation procedures for terminating pregnancies last year. And that's almost all of the abortions.
How many?
3,441.
Gotcha.
Okay. So this is something that like NARAL and Planned Parenthood and ACLU, they're very much opposed to this bill. But it's another
ban this procedure,
you know,
right?
I think that, you know, Ohio Right to Life has been very effective in the last, you know, decade or two of chipping away access to abortion. And this mm-hmm. is just another measure that would do that.
And I think that's why the governor might sign that. I think he might, because he's traditionally, if Ohio Right to Life is on board with abortion legislation, he's signed it.
Yeah. He'll sign that, but it's the heartbeat bill. The right, right to life is
just like
to
2 years ago.
They don't have a position.
Well, they're
neutral.
They've been neutral on it for like 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years ago, the legislature sent him two abortion bills: heartbeat, and then I believe it was the 22 week viability bill. He signed the viability bill. He did not sign. He vetoed heartbeat. It's going to happen again. He's going to veto heartbeat. And the other bill, I'm not certain. I think I've been writing in my stories that he traditionally signs bills that Ohio Right to Life supports, and they are supporting this second trimester bill. And again, this is, you know, Laura gave kind of the number. That's about 16.5%, almost 17% of all abortions last year were done through this D&E method of abortion. And critics say it basically gets rid of second trimester abortions. Nine other states have done this.
Banned this
procedure. Seven of them immediately had their laws put on hold by the courts, who ruled it was unconstitutional. Two, I think they're only in effect in two states right now. I think West Virginia and Mississippi are the only states with this currently in effect. And I'm not sure if that's because they haven't been challenged yet or what has happened. But most of these cases, you know, again, this they want this fight now, though. The abortion activists would like to see these kind of cases get to the Supreme Court, where they think they'll have a more favorable court now that President Trump has made a few additions.
We are going to take a quick break. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles, Dayton Daily News state government reporter Laura Bischoff, and State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel. We've been talking about the lame duck session that resolved in the wee hours of last Friday. They still may return, but it's unclear whether they'll have muster the votes to override possible vetoes by Governor Kasich on two bills. One would be a legislative pay raise that was tucked into a bill intended to improve benefits for the survivors of first responders. And another one is the so-called heartbeat bill that would ban abortion when a fetal heartbeat can be detected by ultrasound or some other kinds of technology. We're not sure how the governor is going to be surrounded to that, but in the past, he has vetoed the heartbeat bill. Wow. There is a question about who's going to be Speaker of the House. This is somewhat – correct me if I'm wrong, but is this unprecedented that they have left the may leave the session without a new Speaker elected? Jim Segal?
Well, it's not that's not the unprecedented part. Okay. The unprecedented part is that they're going to leave without knowing who the next Speaker is going to be. They'll have a Speaker. Ryan Smith is the Speaker.
Oh, okay.
He will continue to be the Speaker until opening day.
Okay.
What they don't know and what they usually do is the majority caucus, whoever it is, usually gets together and behind closed doors takes a vote and all coalesce around whoever has the most votes. And then they come out and they announce this is our leadership team next year. And then on the opening day of session, they take the formal vote on the floor, which is required. And they, but normally it's a formality.
Okay.
It's already been decided. This time, very much not so. There is, Speaker Ryan Smith has been battling Representative Larry Householder, who was the House Speaker from 2001 to 2004, and he wants the job again now that he's back. And
he left with some level of, tainted at the time.
Well, yes, there were definitely controversies involving him when he left. There was an FBI investigation going on that ended up not turning into anything in terms of charges, but yeah, there was, he was not a not without his controversies when he was there. He was also considered by some to be a pretty effective speaker and also a good politician. So these two have been going at it. They've been going at it since June, actually since April, when the former speaker resigned, Cliff Rosenberger,
because of an
FBI investigation. The problem is that the caucus just will not come together and, and decide that we're going to support one of these two, whoever has the most votes in the caucus. So the dean of the caucus, Jim Butler, who's supposed to call the vote behind, the informal vote, has not done so. He's refusing to do so. And so here we are. We're kind of just stuck not knowing exactly what's going to happen. The thought is, I think, that Ryan Smith has the majority of the Republican votes. The problem is he doesn't have 50. You need 50 to win unless you're going to go to a plurality vote on the 11th vote of the House.
Which they did in June.
Which they did in June when he was first elected.
That means it includes Democrats.
Well, they all include Democrats.
Yeah,
okay.
But the Democrats did. No, the plurality. Democrats kept voting. They did not vote for a Republican.
They voted for Fritz Strayhorn.
Right, but they get to vote, though. And that's part of what's going on now, too, is that some of the unions are calling the Democrats saying, we want you to support Larry Householder. So it's conceivable Larry Householder could put together 25 Republican votes and 25 Democrats and have 50 votes and win. And that would certainly be unprecedented, at least in Ohio. You just don't see that kind of thing normally with Democrats and Republicans coming together to elect a leader.
Is Butler delaying or not calling the vote on behalf of Larry Householder or Ryan Smith?
He's a Householder supporter.
Okay. All right.
But I can't say, I don't know for certain that he's doing it on behest of anybody in particular, but I know he is a Householder backer.
With the new people coming in, Strayhorn, if all the Democrats did stay with Strayhorn and didn't go over, and the new Democrats coming in, could he become, I'm asking this as a question, is there a pathway where he could become the speaker, even though he's not
Strayhorn?
Strayhorn, what'd I say?
That would also be very unprecedented.
It would be very unprecedented, but would it be I know
Is
it's improbable. Would it be impossible?
It would not be impossible. In fact, if everyone stuck to their guns right now, and I mean, if all the Democrats voted for Strayhorn and the vote totals I'm hearing about are accurate, it would be a very close between whether Strayhorn would actually win. Now, do I think that would ever come about?
No,
but I do think that they would, Republicans are smart enough to ensure that that's not going to happen. But, but if you just go by what the numbers look like right now, it's not impossible to think that Democrat Fred Strayhorn could become Speaker of a 61-38 Republican controlled House.
That could be a funny thing to cover as a reporter.
And that's in a new session. There are a few more Democrats in the session in the next session.
Yeah, Democrats netted 5 seats.
Okay,
which got them to a 61-38 minority or majority for this Republicans, whatever. So. Yeah. So it'll be interesting. And again, the unions are leaning on the Democrats to vote for Householder because Householder has promised the unions he will not do things like right to work. He will not do things like getting rid of prevailing wage or contract labor agreements or checkoffs.
I'm starting to see new billboards and advertisements opposing right to work, calling it a cancer of the working. I mean, some really vitriolic stuff, which suggests to me, are there concerns among organized labor that right to work is going to...
I think they're constantly worried about that. And if you look at Michigan, they passed a right to work law in a lame duck session. And Rick Schneider, the governor, the Republican governor who's outgoing, and this was, I think, 2 years ago. You know, he had pledged, oh, I'm not going to sign it. Boom. It was signed into law.
By the way, I mean, for listeners, right to work isn't what it sounds like necessarily. It's an anti-union, anti-organized labor
provision
that would eliminate the requirement that you pay dues to an organized labor organization as it represents your shop.
Right.
You know what's interesting is on the lame duck, back to the lame duck. There's a lot of bills that got kind of left below what they call below the black line. Laura Linnese from Grove City was trying to put through a bill that would close a small loophole remaining in state law. On spousal rape, that did not pass. The pink tax.
What's the loophole?
I didn't cover that bill thoroughly. But I just have like a vague understanding of it.
But the bottom line is, it's still legal to rape your spouse.
I think in a very narrow. Ohio eliminated that, but there's like some other
loophole.
Little
gotcha.
Tiny thing.
Okay.
The pink tax,
I was surprised at this.
To suspend the sales tax on tampons and sanitary pads, that cleared through the House. It got attached to a different bill, and it got introduced to the Senate, but then didn't make it out of the Senate. There's a bill pending that Bill Seitz from Cincinnati's been trying to get through for, and Nikki Antonio from the Cleveland area have been trying to get through, which is to prohibit execution of inmates who had serious mental illness at the time of the crime and can document it.
Uh-huh.
That came out of committee on a split vote, and it did not make it to the Senate floor. It was on the agenda and then pulled. And then in the Senate, the Dayton Daily News did a story about a year and a half ago on the incidence of child marriage in Ohio.
Right.
The marriage laws are such that girls can marry at 16 and boys have to wait till they're 18. But there's really no floor. If a girl is pregnant and has the consent from parents and a juvenile court judge, they can get married younger. And we found incidences of 14-year-olds, including a 14-year-old girl who was pregnant and married her 48-year-old boyfriend with parental and court approval. And that spurred, again, Laura Linnese, a state representative from Grove City, Republican, to carry a bill through the House. And it went through the Senate, got through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then did not get a floor vote for some reason.
And
so child marriage laws are
unchanged at this point.
Right.
What else? Anything else didn't get through that surprised you guys?
You know, there was a push by the leader, the Senate President Obhoff and Speaker Smith to change access to the ballot, like through citizen-initiated,
yes,
either constitutional amendments or initiated statutes. And that resolution got some hearings and a lot of pushback from citizen groups because they felt that it would just put more power in the hands of very deep-pocketed interests.
Yeah, I think there was maybe some brief hope among leaders that they could – that might be able to get through quickly and without too much fuss, and it turned into a huge controversial issue. And I do think they'll address it again next session. I do think there's still an intent to pass it, but if they want to pass it in a way that's going to pass on the ballot and not going to face a wave of opposition from the League of Women Voters and other groups like that, they're going to have to make some significant changes to it.
You know, a lot of the significant policies in Ohio came through the ballot in the last 15 years. The indoor smoking ban is a primary example. Casino gambling, even redistricting and medical marijuana came because there was pressure from ballot groups.
Payday lending reform.
Payday lending reform is another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although that took a lot longer.
And that's what they don't want. They don't, I mean, the idea is they don't want to be forced by the overall, the larger electorate
right.
on what they're going to do
right.
in the Ohio General Assembly.
Right. Tying the minimum wage to inflation each year is another one that was put through on the ballot that I just can't even imagine the lawmakers voting for that.
Yeah. I mean, the issue is, do we want folks going to the ballot trying to put constitutional amendments up all the time, or do we want to make it easier for folks to do what's called initiated statutes, which are you go to the ballot to basically have voters pass a law. And lawmakers and frankly, a lot of folks, you know, legal folks who look at this say it would be better to not, you know, junk up the Constitution with things like casino gambling and instead leave those into law. But the problem is that folks, you know, right now the initiated statute process is onerous.
Right.
It takes two batches of signatures and it's a pain in the neck. And the other concern is that as soon as you get one of these passed, the lawmakers, if they wanted to, could come right back into session and change the law.
Right.
Yeah. And so that has not been an option that's been utilized a whole lot.
But
they could change it
without changing the other.
Right.
I mean, it was
two-part
proposal.
Yes.
And they could just change that.
But that would make it easier for voters to have their will in the legislature. And I think that's the key. The legislature doesn't want to feel pressured with this. And so even this proposal that we're talking about, it didn't make it a lot easier to get that initiated statute through. Because if the key was to keep things out of the Constitution, then you would think that they would make it easier for the initiated statute. But a lot of the people who were against this bill said, no, that's not the case.
Well, and also they were only going to make it for a year, you'd have to wait a year before the legislature could undo the initiated statute. Good government groups want it to be 3 or 4 years.
Actually, I think they were calling for maybe a 5-year
safe
safe harbor.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with the resolution now among the opponents is that it takes about 3 steps to make it harder to do a constitutional amendment and takes about a half a step to make it easier to do an initiated statute. And they say that's just not balanced. And it's in the end, they see it as nothing more than a way for, as Joe was saying, the legislature trying to avoid having to be pressured by ballot issues into doing things that the people of Ohio, frankly, want done.
Yeah. I mean, when it came to the medical marijuana, showed well on toward 80% or more.
I think there was some polls that showed 90%.
Yeah, close to 90% wanted some kind of medical marijuana. And by the way, what about that medical marijuana? How's it going?
Nice pivot, Anne. Well, I think the first product is going to be coming out pretty soon. And I think
about 5 people will be able to get it.
I know. And there'll be like 5,000 people lined
people
up.
People are staring at the plants right now, waiting for them to grow. Grow plants.
Little plants.
Actually, they've had some plants that they've grown. Some of the growers have had some plants that have come, you know, full circle. And they've actually had to throw them away.
Why?
Because they can't get them through the rest of the process. They have to be processed. They have to be tested. So, you know, one of the growers told me and you know, that they basically had to trash that what they had and start over and because they couldn't sell that here in Ohio yet.
Yeah, I mean, they may have grown the product, harvested, but then there's no testing labs open yet.
Right.
It has to be tested.
It has to be.
I think there's a dispensary opening, got the go-ahead. It's owned by Cresco Labs, which has the growing operation in Yellow Springs, Ohio, outside of Dayton. And they have permission to open the first dispensary in the state over on the eastern edge of the state. And that's where the line will start, you know, like the line of people who want to get the product available. The available product will be pretty minimal.
I just like calling them dispensaries because it sounds like a vending machine. You just walk up and put a couple dollars in and get your medical marijuana.
It also sounds very dispensary, sounds very clinical, very clean.
Yeah. But again, this was pushed by a ballot issue, a ballot issue that didn't pass, but then they were going to come back and try it again. And then the lawmaker said, okay, we'll do it. And, well, when they do things, they tend to put a lot of layers of bureaucracy in it. And this is where we are now. We're still waiting for when was it supposed to be ready?
September 8th.
Yes, we're still waiting.
And I think Michigan went full legal. And have they opened their first
other states that started with medical, it's always easier to make the jump to.
But does Michigan, are they allowing home grow? I mean, are people?
I think they are.
Are people growing in their basements?
Yeah, I think up to five. You know, some. I don't know. Like,
is five plants is going to be?
It is. I mean, if anyone's going to check, anyways. I mean,
yeah. You know, it's just
crazy.
One of those things that honestly, police officers, I remember going to the Rolling Stones concert, and it was over here at the Shoe, and there are police officers all over the place, right? And there
are smelled
people,
like marijuana everywhere.
People were lighting up, literally lighting up with a police officer standing right there, and they didn't care. They just lit up. And it's like the place just reeked of marijuana. I think there was a crowd there, a big old cloud above us, you know? And so I think that this is probably one of those things that, you know, doesn't get prosecuted a lot, you know? So.
But it gets legislated a lot.
It does.
A lot of legislation.
And it might selectively get prosecuted for some people. And
more,
I think that's.
Disproportionately. Minority communities, African Americans, blah, 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 are affected by these laws. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were talking old geezers, by the way, at that Stones concert.
Of course.
Yeah, it was older
because,
crowd.
Come on. The Stones are old geezers. They are. We are going to continue our conversation. It is, believe it or not, our weekly reporter roundtable. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's kick it off with a question from our listeners. Deborah in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how you all doing?
Good.
Good. I want to say a shame, shame, shame on our legislators for sneaking in the pay raise for legislators and tying it to a bill to give insurance benefits to spouses of our firefighters and police officers who have died in line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
As my understanding from listening to some other people who are former legislators, they haven't had a raise in 10 years.
Right.
People understand that. But They should be brave enough to say, okay, make a separate bill and make a case for it in the papers and other shows or whatever, but don't tie it to a bill that says if you're the wife or could be husband, mm-hmm. the wife of a firefighter or police officer who dies in the line of duty, to give them insurance benefits, because we know that's why it came up. These people got their Social Security for the kids, they got the pension, but the insurance made it difficult for some families to survive, and mm-hmm. I understand that.
Yeah.
Shame, shame, shame on our legislators.
Deborah, thanks for your call. Have they ever just introduced a bill for a legislative pay raise on its own? Or is it always something that's slapped into?
I think it has to go through a bill. And I know that Keith Faber, who he's a Republican from Salina. He's in the state House now. He was the Senate president, and he's going to be the incoming state auditor. He proposed a bill 2 years ago to set up like a legislative pay commission or something. And that didn't fly. I think a lot of lawmakers didn't like the idea of giving up control over that. You know, the last time they voted on a pay raise was in 2001. So forgive me for not having all the details of the circumstance of that. But that gave them like incremental increases through 2008, and then they haven't had increases since then. They're paid $60,800.
That's base, right?
Yeah, base is $60,584. Mm-hmm. And then there's extra, like the finance chairman gets an extra $10,000. You know, the speaker gets more. The
speaker, I think, makes $94,000, if I remember
ostensibly,
right.
Ostensibly, because those jobs are more full-time-ish, I guess.
Well, it's leadership positions.
Yeah, leadership.
Caucus and committee leadership positions get paid a little more. The average salary is more like around 65. Once you factor those in,
okay. They also get a lucrative benefit package that goes along with mm-hmm. that is better than the average bears.
Oh yeah, they get a really nice insurance and pension packages, comparatively speaking, to the average person these days.
It's the same as state employees get. It's not like
right. It's a
think it's even a little bit better in some ways that they can jump from job to job and apply. You know, their credits and stuff a little.
Well, you could serve in the legislature making $60,000 for, 10, 20 years, right. Just ping ponging back and forth between the chambers, and then get an appointment by the governor and to be a department head of such and such. And then your pay raise goes up, or your pay goes up, and then your pension is calculated on your highest 5-year average.
Right.
So.
Another thing interesting in that is that I found, at least, is that it creates incoming Governor Mike DeWine wants to create a new office called Innovate Ohio. Well, this includes language to create that, although I'm pretty sure he could do it by executive order. But this puts it into law. But what's more interesting, I think, is that it actually it creates a pay scale, and the idea is that Lieutenant Governor John Husted is going to be appointed as the head of Innovate Ohio, and under this bill, he would be paid $176,426 to do that job. His salary.
Okay.
His salary would be $176,000, and that would be, you're wondering, that's $11,000 more than I believe the governor is going to make. So,
and one thing to remember, too, is this is actually a part-time legislature.
Right.
And so most of these folks have another job on the side. So $70,000 and then you've got another gig on the side that, could produce, maybe a couple $100,000 if you're, an attorney or a doctor or something like that. So you never know how much people are actually getting. This is just a base.
Right.
Let's see. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to see if you guys know the latest on the tax credit for movies, the 30% tax credit bill, to see. Last I heard, it was being folded into another bill, but the $40 million cap might be preserved. To see if you guys know what the latest is.
I do not.
I do not. It got kind of got lost.
I haven't heard anything about the tax credit bill in a long time.
There's something to check on.
Yeah. I don't know where that is.
Thanks for the heads up, John.
It seemed to me that kind of faded away with Cliff Rosenberger's investigation by the FBI.
Because
some of his trips involved going
to California,
movie studios and things wooed on that. So that it suddenly became a little bit tainted. And so that could be it, but why we haven't heard much about it.
Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Yeah, I'm curious, since we haven't had a gas tax raise in probably at least 10, 15 years, and our roads need it, why, when the gas is so low now, why don't they jump in and raise it by a dime or something?
Well, because they can't get agreement, number one. I mean, they had played around with that. They've played around with it for the last few years. And one of the things that they looked at was like the usage and how much you use it. And maybe they should tax on usage rather than put in a full, tax on things. And then, they've talked about, the possibility of maybe encompassing, the gas, the roads in another kind of bigger initiative, maybe like some sort of bond package and that sort of thing. So I think they've talked about it and they've proposed some things, but they just haven't done anything.
So the last gas tax raise was, I think, in 2005. Alan's right. It hasn't been boosted since then. I think there's a little bit of talk about maybe looking at a way to tax electric and higher fuel economy cars a little bit more, since they're still using the roads but not paying as much. Although, the number of electric cars on Ohio roads is
very small. And they're little cars, too. They're not generally the big cars that are doing the real damage.
And the question you asked, the question, why with the gas prices low, don't they jump in and do this? Well, the simple answer is that regardless of what the gas prices are, the attack ads that'll run next campaign won't care about the gas prices.
It's only 2 years away.
Yes, they'll only the attack ads will only care about whether they voted for a tax increase on gas. Now, that being said, yes, look for something to happen next year. This state is literally running out of time to do this, and without having significant impact on the ability to do big road projects. I mean, the turnpike bonding is running out. We are literally running out of money in the state to do road projects, and the legislature is going to be as it sometimes happens. The legislature does not act until absolutely forced to, and I think it's getting to that point.
Speaking of another issue, and Alan, thanks a lot for that call. The unemployment compensation trust fund remains underfunded. It will not survive too many months of another recession. Even if we have a lighter recession than we had in 2008, they did not do anything.
Yeah, this has been a chronic problem. Essentially, it's not enough money going in and too much money going out. And the labor doesn't want to agree to benefit cuts, and businesses don't want to agree to tax increases. This has been going on for 10 plus years. There was a big push to try and fix it, but just they have not come to agreement on it.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a can that's been kicked down the road by the legislature more than this. Mm-hmm. They could have acted. They could have done this years ago. They had basic agreements. But at the end of the day, no one wants to make either business or labor too unhappy. Nothing ever gets done. And then the two sides have dug in. The business side and labor side. I mean, labor is looking at it like, why should we agree to benefit cuts when if the fund runs out of money again, you know what happens? The businesses get hit with surcharges in order to pay back the federal government, because we end up borrowing from billions of dollars from the feds. Mm-hmm. So the businesses obviously do not want to pay more. So, but they're going to if this doesn't get fixed again. And frankly, that's the road we're heading toward unless we muster up some political courage at the State House.
Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of big issues for them to get to next year.
Another one, criminal sentencing reform. That was what the voters were asked to consider on issue one this year. It failed. For the usual reasons people speculate, that it's just complicated and voters are wary of changing the Constitution in this way, even though the state law, they tend not to, but it tends to force the legislature to action. Any chance that'll happen?
I think there's a high likelihood of it. I think that this has been signaled by both Speaker Smith and Senate President Abhoff that this is going to be a priority. They're very sensitive to the storyline that the legislature hasn't done anything on criminal justice reform. They'll point to like a reduction in collateral sanctions. It's like where you get convicted on one thing and then you get out of prison and it turns out you can't be a barber or you can't do this. You can't get this kind of licensing or what have you. They did a sentencing reform bill back in, I think, 11 or 12 that changed some stuff. But, I don't know that they've really packaged and sold it to the public that way. Abhoff is talking about doing a redo of drug sentencing laws. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a group of smart policy people working on a thing called justice reinvention. And they'll probably come up with a big, long report that gives all kinds of recommendations. But if past practices followed, a lot of times those big policy recommendations just gather dust. The lawmakers are reluctant to implement a lot of changes.
And they're going to have to take a look at this issue of people who have a criminal background. And can they get jobs? Because that's huge for a lot of people. And we've got a state where a lot of businesses are saying, hey, we can't hire people. We can't find people to do these jobs. We can't, if they can't get licensed in a certain field, if they can't get a job because they have a certain past, I mean, something's going to have to be done to make sure that you connect people with jobs. Because honestly, if someone comes out of prison and they can't get a job, anyone will tell you their likelihood of recidivism goes straight back up,
Right. this doesn't.
Well, and I think the one hope, I think, of having the lawmakers, the Republicans who are in charge, kind of, you know, take on these issues is that it is turning out to be a big drag on the economy. When you have so many people with criminal convictions, it harms their ability to get jobs. Right. And
once again, because of the disproportionality, you know, by which the laws are or the people are charged with criminal particularly with drug crimes, it affects certain neighborhoods a lot more than others.
Right.
Elizabeth, and is it New Springfield?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Elizabeth. You're on the air. Welcome.
Okay, I'm replying to your earlier caller about raising the gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
My county is trying to raise my license plate tax for the third time. I pay an extra $5 to my city. I pay an extra $10 to my county. And now they want to raise it another $5 to pay for roads.
Huh. So at the county level, they're having to deal with this. I haven't heard of that, but I didn't realize that people paid different rates for license plates in different counties.
The counties can tack on.
Counties can tack on surcharges for those things for local projects. And And again, this is an ongoing spiraling issue. There's a problem with, you know, as folks tend to use less gas, move toward maybe more higher efficiency cars, there's less gas tax. However, we continue to build more roads, and not just more roads. We continue to widen the ones we have,
mm-hmm.
and that just costs more money. So, and the just generally inflation causes things to cost more money, particularly in construction and materials. So you end up with a continuing increase in your cost, and the money coming in just is not keeping pace.
Right.
And that is continuing to be a problem. And that's why I do think next year you'll see legislators having to deal with this in some fashion.
You know, they could just raise the speed limits and then people get lousier gas mileage and pay more in gas taxes.
You know, and we're also seeing across the state where new planning, when projects come in and they need infrastructure, they'll actually tack on some sort of tax to this new, you know, to the employees usually of these new projects and try to get them to pay for that infrastructure need so that the county doesn't have to fork that money over. And we've seen that in Delaware County that's happened, but it's all over the state. I've read different projects where, you know, they come in and they want to put in this big thing and they levy some sort of extra tax on the people who would work in that area.
The question is anyone ever going to get serious about light rail or other type
alternative
transportation methods that don't just involve getting in a car and driving?
And that's, you know, that really hurts us a lot of times. You see big businesses that are considering, or even like the convention, the Democratic convention was looking at coming in and using, I believe it was Columbus years ago. And mm-hmm. and that's often cited. The transportation and the lack of being able to get around in public transportation is often cited as one of the reasons that we don't get those advances, yet we're not seeing anything in the legislature that says, let's look at that.
Again, it's another drag on the economy. If people can't get to their jobs because, you know, they have to take three buses and it takes an hour and a half each way, that's problematic.
Mm-hmm. That is it. I want to thank you all so much for joining us. As always, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, appreciate your time today.
It's always great to be here.
And Jim Siegel, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter, came in on his day off. I'd like to notice that.
Thanks all right.
Thanks for the extra effort, Jim.
I love it here.
Thank you.
I should pay you to be here.
Yeah. Okay. And with that, thank you for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.